I am Plato on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Noah Richler's new book, The Candidate, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, is probably the first memoir from the 2015 federal election campaign that saw the Harper government defeated and the Justin Trudeau Liberals swept into office, leaving the official opposition NDP and its leader Thomas Mulcair in third place. Mr. Richler was a candidate in last year's election. He was one of those high-profile candidates that run because of name recognition, the ability to fundraise, as well, of course, the desire to serve the constituency they seek to represent. In the riding of Toronto-St. Paul's, Noah Richler was up against a Liberal incumbent who had been in office 18 years up to that point. He recounts in the book why he ran, how he did it, and the myriad of challenges along the way. The book provides insight into a historic election, as well as the stuff that candidates have to go through, whether it's campaigning door-to-door, reflecting a national party in one's riding, reacting to events outside the riding that invariably have an effect on how people vote, as well as the party apparatus that is very often there to simply confound candidates. Noah Richler is a writer and broadcaster who for 14 years made documentaries and features for BBC Radio before returning to Canada in 1998 when he joined the National Post as its books editor, then a literary columnist. He's contributed to a number of noted publications, including The Guardian, Punch, The Daily Telegraph, The Walrus, Maisonneuve, Saturday Night, The Toronto Star, and The Globe and Mail. His previous book, This Is My Country, What's Yours, was the recipient of the 2007 BC National Award for Canadian Nonfiction. Noah will be participating in at least two events at this year's Vancouver Writers' Fest. Visit writersfest.bc.ca for tickets and information. The book is published by Doubleday. At Know Where You Are is the Twitter handle. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto today, Noah Richler. Mr. Richler, good morning.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for being interested.
Oh, it's a great book, as I was telling you just before we started. How long after the campaign did you decide that there was a book to write?
Well, in fact, somebody had asked me in the few weeks after a loss I'd been warned were a low time and not to make any decisions. And I said, no, this is silly. I was in politics for several months. I don't have a book. And so I did phone up a pal at the Walrus and say, look, I'm sure there's a magazine article on this. And wrote 20,000 words in 3 weeks and realized there was a book. And I met up with Scott Sellers. We've been friends for a long time, but I've never actually published with Doubleday Canada. Mm-hmm. And he was keen, and he imposed a rigorous schedule so that we could get it out a year to the day, which is enticing to me.
Yeah.
But I have to say, the only way I was able to do that, because I'm not a fast writer, was almost to behave like Jackson Pollock and just throw everything I could remember down on paper without worrying about my notes and records, and I had extensive records, and then let a narrative emerge. And it was terrific fun. I really enjoyed writing this book.
So why did you run? Because I remember when we found out about it in the news and the sort, I'm sure, like a lot of people close to you, wondered why you were doing this. I mean, and I'm sure when you canvassed your family and friends, they must have told you you were somewhat nuts to do it. Were you? What was
there? Yeah, no, I actually called a couple of journalist pals, first of all, and folk more in the know than me, because in truth, I mean, 15-year-olds knew about running, more about running for politics than I did.
Mm-hmm.
And they almost uniformly said, are you crazy? And why would you do that? It's a terrible life, and of all places, where I Toronto, St. Paul's. But, you know, like so many in Canada, like a majority of people in Canada, I was just fed up with Harper, especially after the yet more sort of trying to poison the Canadian public and fill their minds with fear and hatred after the attacks on the Charlie Hebdo magazine in Paris. And it just felt like something needed to be done. It was very scary. I mean, lots of people were imagining that we might have more of this and that finally it would be too much. And, you know, as a writer, I imagine that I've always been a fairly political writer, but you know that your ideas have a particular kind of reach, so I wanted to try and extend that or shake it up for something more immediate. And, in the hurly-burly of the back and forth with the NDP, Toronto St. Paul's, which is an extremely wealthy, comfortable riding, came up, and it's been Liberal for nearly two decades now. And I think they were surprised, as the local writing association was, when I said, sure, I'll do that, because it felt to me like a way to bring ideas to the table and kind of elevate the argument a little bit.
Yeah, and what's interesting is this writing that you ran in, you don't really live in, and a lot of people in that writing, some of your volunteers even, had been delivered by the incumbent Liberal.
Yeah, that's the truth. And I kept wanting the chance to say, listen, I'm going to deliver the biggest baby of all, and it's going to be 300 MPs big, but that didn't happen.
Now, you spend a lot of time in Nova Scotia as well, is that right?
I was sort of there on that baby thing.
Yeah.
It's funny about stories, because that was a story that people really liked to tell. You know, it was kind of tedious to listen to all the time, and less true as the years went on, but somehow it was an appealing story for the narrator, and I was aware of that. You know, I'm really interested in stories, and that was one that people liked to be able to share.
Now, as I said a moment ago, you spend a lot of time in Nova Scotia, is that correct?
I do, yeah.
You even thought of running there, is that correct?
I did. I loved the part of Nova Scotia that I spent a good deal of time in, that I think of myself as doing my best writing in, along the Digby Neck, which is a spit of land that sinks into the Bay of Fundy on the backside of the southern part of Nova Scotia. And I had a sort of romantic scheme, because the writing is shaped a bit like a tuning fork, with Digby up at the center, and the Digby Neck being one arm and the French Shore being another. And I had this idea that I might, a la Joey Smallwood, kind of walk from one foot of the riding all the way up to Digby and down the other side. And I'd still love to be able to do that sometime. But the NDP were fantastically unimpressed. And local NDP even warned me that I didn't have a chance because of certain local issues. And in the end, I felt okay about that, because I think as writers we need a hideaway or a third place, and Nova Scotia offers that to me, and I didn't want relationships there to be jaundiced by having declared myself partisan for one party or another.
And you'd also thought at the outset of the different parties, other than, say, Mr. Harper's.
Not a great deal, but
no.
I had sort of sounded it out.
Yeah.
I try and convey, I don't know if I do so altogether successfully in the book, but at least I worry that the political choices or choices of political allegiance we make are not entirely rational or founded in policy platforms and so on, but they have a personal and a family element, and that I was aware that there was a certain rebellious streak in me that just was not going to have myself be Liberal, because many in my milieu, my parents' milieu, were. I thought it was really important to show to Canadians that a reasonably intelligent fella would align himself with this third party and imagine an alternative.
And, I mean, at the time, at the start of the election, it wasn't the third party, it was the number two party, and it was doing well in the polls, right?
Yes, it was, yeah. And it couldn't help but be excited by the timely victory of Rachel Notley's provincial and NDP bunch in Alberta. And I think that actually, I'm an outside observer as you are, but I think that essentially jarred the thinking of the folk in Ottawa who imagined themselves to themselves as a government in waiting, and that's a bad ploy. It doesn't work in sports, it doesn't work in politics to imagine if you just hold on, you'll do okay. And I think that affected the campaign from the beginning. It was a very rigid campaign. It was remarkably unable to be agile and respond to situations that became dire exactly for that reason, you know, the deficit. I'm sure that if Tom Mulcair had said, oh, well, that's interesting. I feel compelled to, balance the books. It's a responsibility not to spend your children's money, but I'm really relieved to know that Canadians are prepared to go into debt, and we'll try not to, but if we do, we know that we have your permission.
Yeah.
Boom, that whole issue would have gone by the wayside.
You give us insight into the process of what it's like to be a candidate, and you just spoke to that a moment ago about the, sort of the rigidity of the party apparatus during a campaign. Mm-hmm. There was some question about some posts that you'd made on social media. I think it was Facebook.
Sure. Yeah.
And
yeah.
And so these had emerged during the campaign. Is that right?
They did. I mean,
yeah.
If the book works, and I hope it does, it'll appeal across party lines. The thing that struck me coming out of it, and during the whole process, was just how many people come out and work for nothing to make these things possible.
Yeah.
And I did find that very affecting. I hadn't set out to write a book at the outset, but I didn't get the job I wanted, so this is what I do.
Yeah.
But I don't want to paint the NDP campaign, which in a sense was trying to catch up with its successful self. I mean, they tried to make it work, and Facebook posts and Twitter posts that any more experienced politician would have hidden immediately, I assumed weren't being seen by people, had been vetted by the party, they were not on public view, that in the Facebook lexicon they were available only to friends, but of course how foolish of me to think that my friends were my friends, and so on. My wife, Sarah, had always advised me not to write them, let alone not to keep them up there. And they're not that particularly, they're not that bad, I can defend each of them, but they ended up in being used to embarrass me. I made a video that was tremendously successful, that was threatening to the Liberals, that gently mocked Trudeau's escalator ad, and did so quite successfully. And no coincidence, within 24 hours, La Presse, The Star, and The Citizen all had stumbled upon different posts, and not even the most noxious ones that suited the identity of their papers. And there's no question in my mind that this stuff was handed to them.
Yeah.
That was confirmed to me fairly explicitly by the one journalist who responded to my calls. That's just dirty dealing that's utterly routine in the 21st century. The Democratic Party in the United States were doing it to one of their own, to Saunders and so on. But, I also feel for Mulcair at the top, because any job in too large a company becomes embroiled in human resources, and there's a way in which one of the last thing you want to do is actually hear from the 338 candidates you have out there. And, what a headache I must have been. But they did try and stick by me for a while, but I eventually chickened out.
Do you think that we'll soon get away from social media posts as being, say, a hindrance to running the longer we have these things? I mean, I'm 34, so to me, I mean, I've been on social media, say, half my life, if you will, it'll be more comfortable for say, politics to comprehend what people have posted in the past?
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, if I don't have any regrets, it was a terrific experience. But the one mild disappointment I have is that I was not able, as I had offered to the party to do, to run or off a column to the Toronto Star for them to run, but I contributed fairly regularly and I probably would have done it, saying, look, I'm sorry. I'm not saying sorry. I don't apologize. I put these posts up. I own them. If you want to find stuff that's more obnoxious, you can go to my published stuff. I can't pretend that it was written in the passion of the moment, but you can't do this if you want decent people to run. And I believe that. Frankly, I even believe that taking recordings that Donald Trump, to the south of us, made 11 years earlier is unnecessary. It's especially unnecessary when you only have to go to what he said last week. But that there's a mechanism which is fantastically lazy in the media and done, we're in an age where people are scandalized as they used to be in the stocks. And one result of my own experience is that any time I'm witness to internet justice, I'm somewhat cautious in deciding a person is guilty, which as a writer you always are anyway, and somewhat wary, of the kind of persecution that happened here in Toronto very recently with a guy who threw the beer can at the baseball game.
Mm-hmm.
It's excessive, it's dangerous, it's the internet is a strange house of just a few moods. One of them is a deep earnestness, and the other is a kind of railing anger. And as a writer, I'd say I'm also interested, if not worried, that an effect of all this is that we're going to lose our ability to read irony and satire. There are certain bits in my book. I'll be interested to see how it goes with the folk, because if we're constantly looking for the two words that can do a person in, plucked out of context, as invariably they are, and they were with me, but there's no point arguing context when this thing happens, then, you know, I think writers, as I felt was happening to me as well, are going to be more cautious writing satire. And so maybe we'll lose a bit of that. But I think that's a temporary blip. You know, I would hope that by the time you're my age, and I'm 56, people will just be so much more savvy.
Mm.
You know, as parents, we used to be upset when we discovered pictures of our kids drinking, you know, doing selfies and having a beer in the back of a cab or something. And then you just realize that everybody's, you know, taking those pictures, and hardly the scandal you think it is.
Yeah.
So I think we're kind of in a period of strange dishonesty when we sign on to these accusations.
Speaking of satire and irony, prior to this interview, did you Google me and look at the images and say, yeah, okay, I'll talk to him?
No, I did not. But I know what you're referring to. And, you know, satire works when you can imagine it being true, I think, or when it decently reflects what goes on. And I'm not a sitting MP.
Yeah.
You know, you're quoting for one of those satirical scenes in which I'm an MP enjoying less and less power. But it was fun to imagine myself as a cocksure, irresponsible, expense-fiddling guy ensconced in Ottawa.
And a sense of entitlement, too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And a couple of scenes I did cut, even though I thought they were a bit too much.
What heartened me in reading your book was these scenes where you were talking to constituents, where you're talking to voters, and just how engaged a lot of them are. Because I think we tend to think of the average citizen, the average voter, as not really paying attention. But the people that you ran into, for the most part, were tuned in and they knew what the issues were in that campaign.
Totally. I mean, inevitably, you ran into some. Indeed, the first person I spoke to whose knowledge of politics was such that this octogenarian Italian woman asked me to make sure that the tree in her neighbor's yard was cut down, which is not really the federal MP's job. And, you know, you come across that kind of funny confusion from time to time. And I ended up helping one woman with her Toronto hydro bill, another woman who couldn't speak English. But, I, you know, for someone, and I was thinking, okay, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to be knocking on doors for a few months. I have to be prepared for a kind of sock to the side of the head. That never happened. And I was actually really, I found it quite remarkable how folk with, you would think, so much more to worry about, not the least of which is, you know, the rent to pay the money to pay the immediate bills, had on their minds, you know, things like the muzzling of scientists or the long-form census, how we conduct our foreign policy. And they were basically engaged. And I was treated with remarkable grace overall. People were actually kind of really good to me. Only towards the end, in an election that was basically 3 weeks too long for everybody and 3 weeks too long for the NDP, certainly, was there a certain fatigue. But it wasn't because, and where you felt people had decided how they were going to vote, and so they'd much rather get on with something else.
Yeah.
But especially in the early weeks of the campaign, whether it was because it was summer or because the NDP were in the lead, I'm not sure, and they seemed the prospect of winning, folk were amazingly generous.
So let's play the what-if game. Had the campaign been shorter, do you think the NDP would have done better?
Yes. Had the campaign been shorter, let's see, it was the NICAD issue would have happened and the deficit issue would have happened, but they've lost quite so badly. They probably would have lost, but they might have been in a minority. I'm not sure. The NICAD issue was interesting, because, as has been argued by others, the spectacle of Quebecers being angry with the NDP and turning away from the NDP made folk in the rest of Canada decide that the NDP was no longer sufficiently strong to be an alternative to Harper, so went with the Liberals. I think that, as I say, Mulcair's campaign's lack of agility was an issue. But we're a very conservative bunch. I mean, just the idea that the right to fill out this long-form census was contentious is kind of amusing if you distance yourself from it.
Yeah.
About the right to fill out a form. That would hardly be a contentious issue in Colombia. But we're a cautious bunch, and we've always veered between these two parties. Not for a moment do I agree with all the nonsense that was written after the election, in which people are saying, what's the point of the NDP? Why do we need a third party? You only have to look south to see why a third party is a good idea. And as even one of the most vicious liberal operatives I know, who's also a drinking pal, says, is the bare minimum for a democracy to be called that, a liberal democracy, a parliamentary democracy, is two parties.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of the NDP actually having done not badly. I feel more optimistic than many, and that it is able to be the party of invention. There's a lot that comes with not being in power.
Yeah.
You know, I was aware of that too, that we could make all sorts of claims because we've never actually had to deal with being in power.
The other thing that we have to consider with regards to this election, the 2015 federal election, as historic as it was that Justin Trudeau, I mean, his brand just sort of overwhelmed everyone, didn't it?
Well, one of the moments in the book where I'm sort of waiting for somebody to react with fury in that sort of manner I was describing with no sense of irony is a moment at which, late in the day, we're all pretty exhausted, and I sit in the office, and there's yet another picture of Trudeau with a carefully arranged bank of prospective candidates whose diversity used to be the property of the NDP and now of the Liberals. And I have turned to Doug Bell, the guy who got me into this whole thing, and said, there's never anybody of substance in these photos, it's just women and children, women and young people. And I realized, believe me, how everything that was wrong with that idea, but not to the extent that I foresaw that the Liberals would corral 4 million new young voters, and it was amusing. And I've left it completely naked. I haven't tried to qualify it or make myself look better. I made this sort of gaffe remark, and to an extent, it's a reflection of how we're still stuck in an older world of what is viable and possible in politics. That said, I was always urging the NDP, when they were in opposition, to kind of run a big poster with Harper and all his Nixonian thugs on that front row, the awful bench with Jason Kenney and Julian Infantino and Peter Van Loan and so on, all their staunch waists pushing at their double breasted suits and so on. And then to have another with the extraordinary faces that the NDP had in Parliament at that time, amongst them the McGill Four, all in their early 20s, and then Nikki Ashton, and just say, we are you, Canada. All these slogans are now liberal.
Yeah. You mentioned a moment ago the escalator video, which did well online.
Yeah.
The other video that you talk about in the book is the one where footage of Harper's interview with Peter Mansbridge and then you come into it and you kick Harper out of the chair.
And then I take a seat and explain what changes to Peter Mansbridge.
Yeah. How long was that online for before it was taken down?
It was online for less than half a day and 40,000 views at least. It was going viral at a faster rate than the earlier one.
Yeah.
And, I talk about that because though on the one hand I think it was tremendously childish of the CBC, but I understand they're stuck in sort of survival mode and ever vigilant to possible injury. But I thought it was remarkably unsophisticated of them to threaten to take it down. The idea that somehow my using a legally defensible few seconds of Peter Mansbridge footage from his interview in the National with Stephen Harper was a transgressed copyright is ludicrous, and I had taken measures to make sure the public understood it was not a real broadcast, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's a corporation. They don't get that. The reason they're upset is generally no good. It's because they go to such pains to warn people that it's a joke. And I think, you know, so many years of budget cuts has left them rather desperately or in a desperate frame of mind, and decisions, and I would say even editorial decisions, are compromised by the basic will to survive. But it's not even that that was really sort of interesting to me. I've had several corporate employers, and with any of them, if I said, look, I'm going to do something, this may result in somebody threatening to sue, here's the case we can make. If that bunch signs on, then they go to the wall with me, and the NDP didn't. The NDP cowered, and I think they did so. I mean, they had their own concerns. I was just a little nobody in a riding that they weren't going to win. But it was indicative to me of in what state of anxiety they were operating in those last couple of weeks before the election. And, of course, I wasn't going to be obstinate, so I took it down. Mm-hmm. Didn't want anybody on my own team to think it was grandstanding. But it was instructive.
No,
I went to a bar and I was watching the Texas Rangers lose, and I emailed my bunch and I said, sir, I'm watching another team make a bunch of unforced errors to lose the game. That's sort of what it felt like.
Yeah. Was there anything in the course of writing this book that you held back? And at the same time, is there anything in this book that could preclude you from running again, say?
I believe in not censoring yourself in the first instance. I think if you write cautiously, you don't write as well. So there was stuff I cut that seemed not quite to work. And you know, those were probably decent decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the satirical bits were a bit, you know, a little bit off. But as for, is there anything in this book that might preclude my running again? That's not really for me to decide. But what I would say is that there's nothing in that book that I wouldn't be able to speak to the subject's face. And for me, the best barometer of whether or not you're going too far is that one. You know, what I do, you know, once in my first book, This Is My Country, What's Yours, I wrote a scene involving a writer in Saskatchewan who was clearly depressed, and I knew even as I was writing it that I was writing it for literary advantage, and did. And if I met this man again, I certainly wouldn't avoid him. I would have to apologize. I would feel slightly ashamed, which is probably why I'm not a novelist. and I can speak anything in this book to the people I'm writing about. And I don't think the NDP are going to be upset. I mean, it's an exercise in transparency, and politicians are always going on about that.
Yeah. What do you say?
And I hope it's impressive to people who haven't entered the game.
Yeah. So what do you say to people who might come up to you now and say, you know, I'm thinking about participating, not even running, but just say volunteering even and things like that? I mean, surely you'd encourage that, right?
Absolutely. I have, and I'd say in a completely unqualified way, go for it.
Yeah.
I think it's great. I think it's really important to participate. And this was one of the best experiences of my life. I mean, I feel only... I'm really still pleased by it. I think writing the book really helped. It helped me to make sense of the whole thing. For once, I sound like the writer explaining, you know, catharsis or, you know, that, mm-hmm. What's the word? But there's some resolution in writing, but that's true. And I hope that the book acts as a kind of celebration of all the people coming out. It was very important to me to try and get that. The fact of my being just one piece in an enterprise, and so that's why I worked hard to corral the testimonials from a bunch of people, so it wasn't me speaking only from my point of view. But But I would hope that, I mean, one person did say to me, oh, nobody will run for the NDP again, and I was very surprised by that. To me, it's a big emotional journey, but it's a pretty happy book.
Yeah, it's a great book, and
thank you.
It's instructive. I guess it's one of the first books about this campaign, isn't it?
I think it is, yeah.
Well, congratulations on it, Noah, and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Well, and yours, and thank you for reading.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Candidate, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Noah Richler, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.